And Smashville, good morning, and thank you for joining us. It is Morning Drive. We're off and running here on a Friday. ESPN 102.5 The Game, broadcasting live from Kitchen Notes inside of the Omni Nashville Hotel. Nikhail Bradengall, Derek Mason, the Constable, Chase McKay, back in the Game Nashville studios, presented by Wholesale Inc., Mount Juliet. Happy Friday, boys. How's it?
What's going on?
Who stayed up to watch the whole thing?
I did.
Oh.
Yeah, I should have. I basically stayed up to watch the whole thing.
I went to bed about mid-third quarter. Did I miss anything when I went to bed and Portland had a 14-point lead?
Short-lived.
Well, Portland missed a lot of shots.
Oh, man, they were taking shots just to be taking shots.
I knew I should have gone to bed. I knew I didn't have to watch that.
I mean, Portland, that was their chance to win. That was their chance to steal a game in Oracle Arena, and they blew it. Just like Toronto blew a chance to win in Milwaukee. But it was even worse with Portland because they had a 14-15-point lead. They had command of the game, and they just blew it, royally blew it, and they cannot blame anyone but themselves. Mm. This might be.
How is it not over?
Yeah, I don't know how it's not over. Portland might pull a game out of their pocket, one, but this is over with.
Well, I think we all collectively said, what, Golden State in five?
Well, you said Golden State in 10.
Yeah, I said they're going to win it in 10.
So you've already given them two rounds worth, and you're not too far off already.
The NHL last night, Boston sweeps Carolina. They win 4-0. And how about this? From a Stanley Cup conference final perspective. Now, Boston goes back, I believe, to the Stanley Cup for the first time in 6 years. But that series, I mean, Carolina didn't even actually get off the bus and compete. They totally outscored 17-5 over the course of four games. That never happens in the NHL in a conference final.
Oh, wow.
You know, I'd like to go back and sort of see, because I feel like there's the improbability of a Carolina run to the conference finals, it doesn't necessarily – like. And I was reading a really good piece from Wyshynski yesterday about just the pure chaos and how NHL GMs are going to try to learn something from these playoffs and how they shouldn't, that, like, these playoffs are just an indication of how you shouldn't take anything from the NHL playoffs, like, that they're just pure chaos. Derek, you were talking about this yesterday, right? Like, it's just anything can happen, right? Like, once you get in. I'm not surprised. Like, Boston was one of the premier franchises, premier teams all year. Carolina was just struggling to keep its head above water most of the season. And when you get to a conference finals, I think Portland's in the same boat here. Mm-hmm. You're just going to run out of steam when you go up against a team that's one of the better teams in the league. That's why St. Louis and San Jose is different, right? Because St. Louis had played unbelievable hockey for basically 4 months. So we'll see if the Western Conference Finals are better, but I'm not surprised with Boston. I had the winner of the Boston-Toronto series going to the Cup Final, and I had the winner of the San Jose-Vegas series going to the Cup Final, and we'll see if that works out.
When you look at both of these conference finals for both the NHL and the NBA, and you look at the teams involved, not necessarily – I mean, you've got St. Louis and San Jose. You've got Boston-Carolina. You know, Carolina and St. Louis maybe surprises. Then you get to the NBA, Portland a surprise – probably not much of a surprise in the East, but have these playoffs, and I'm just going to broad brush this right here, the NBA and the NHL collectively, has their postseasons been underwhelming this year to you?
I say no to both. I mean,
no?
I think different reasons, right? I think the NBA has been fun because it's been more competitive earlier, right? We saw, I know it's a function of Houston and Golden State playing in the second round, but also I think the Eastern Conference Finals, we would all agree, were pretty darn good. So that was sort of a change. We actually saw good semifinal action, not just quarterfinal action, right? Second round and third round could be really good. So I think the NBA is a little bit up, in my opinion, just from what I would normally consider entertaining. And then the NHL, I mean, when you have the wildest, craziest, most bizarre postseason in NHL history, ratings are way up at an all-time high from a TV standpoint. And you have four division champions all losing in the first round, the greatest team in 25 years in Tampa Bay losing in the first round. I think there's drama there. So I would say they're both maybe up a tick.
But it feels
so
like
– Now can I change my mind if the championship series and both of them are duds?
Sure.
But I think right now, to date, I would say they're both like up a little bit.
It feels different, though, to me for the NHL because, yeah, you had all those upsets in the first round, all those teams that you mentioned going out, and it feels like March Madness for me. We're like, okay, I'm in the moment, and I'm loving these upsets, except for the Preds. And then once you realize Carolina and St. Louis are in the conference finals, you're like, I don't want to see the long shot go that deep.
Yeah, you would want to see maybe one or two upsets in a playoff series. But you don't want to see all of the, you know, favorites go out early. And then you have a, you know, a Western Conference Finals or Eastern Conference Finals, and they're with teams that, you don't recognize with. And you get a situation where Boston outscores,
right,
you know, one team 17-5. You just don't, that's not competitive. That's not compelling. It does nothing for
right.
anyone. And it does nothing for the sport.
And that's the same in the tournament, right? Mm-hmm. Like the tournament, we love Cinderella in the first weekend, and then we want her to sort of go home. Mm-hmm. By the Elite Eight, I want to see North Carolina, Kentucky, and Virginia versus Duke, or Michigan State versus Duke, you know, like we saw, or Gonzaga versus, you know, Michigan or Florida State or Texas Tech or whatever. You want to see the best teams in the sport in those last three rounds. You don't mind Cinderella the first half of the tournament, and I think that's again, if we get San Jose or St. Louis, obviously, versus Boston, which is what we're going to get two of the better teams, at least, in the NHL. They may not be mm-hmm. the best teams in the NHL, but we're not going to get, like, an 8 seed, right? We're not going to get a Cinderella story in there. If it's Toronto or Milwaukee, you're going to get one of the two best teams in the East, right, versus mm-hmm. probably Golden State, the best team in the world. So at least on paper, it looks like we're going to get great championship series from a – paper standpoint. It doesn't mean Golden State doesn't roll through them, but it doesn't look like a Cinderella is going to make. Had Carolina mm-hmm. pulled an upset, I think the ratings for the NHL Stanley Cup final might have dipped. But Boston is a huge market, huge team, really good team all year long with star power. I don't think, especially San Jose with their star power, I don't, you know, St. Louis might slow it down a little bit, but if it's San Jose versus Boston, you're going to be going up and down the ice all night, and that's going to be fun, I think, for people.
Yesterday, also, the first round of the PGA Championship, and I don't like to say that it's over after one round, but Brooks Koepka might have sucked the life out of Bethpage Black yesterday by just squashing a majority of the field, 7-under
so
round one.
You tell me, I might go too deep in the weeds here, and Nick, you can tell me, like literally, almost. So
stay out of the weeds. You're never going to hit your
head. But that's where Koepka. That's right. So I was watching some highlights of Koepka because I didn't get a chance to see much of it. Even though I said I was going to go watch it, I didn't get to see much of it. They kept showing highlights, and they said he was like it didn't look like he was in the fairway much. I mean, all his best shots they were showing on the highlights were all these like, oh, you're in the rough, 205 yards away. You're going to put it up on. Oh, you're going to go for the green.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and he just there's a confidence with him right now. That I think is,
well, some would say it's cockiness.
Well, right, and he's like, listen, I'm paraphrasing here, but I don't know what the quote was, but he's basically like, I'm the best player in the world right now, basically. Is what he's saying.
His quote, either before yesterday's round or on Wednesday was, I'm drawing a blank now. Hold on a second.
Something about like I'm playing better than anybody else, or I'm the best player.
Well, that too, but he said majors are easier to win.
That's what it was.
Than regular events, and then he explained. He said, half of the field has no chance. 40% of the field will collapse. I only have to beat a handful of guys.
Well, I mean,
is that cocky?
That's some stones right there.
I mean, technically.
He fires a 63 yesterday?
I mean, technically, he's right. He's the defending champ. He's been playing well all year. What in his, you know, run in the last couple of years tells you he's not going to play well?
Yeah. That's true.
I mean, he's tailor-made for this course.
Ooh, I see what he did there. Tailor-made.
For this course, he hits the long ball, and this course is very, very long.
Look at this guy.
So, you know, I mean, it's confidence. Some people will take it as confidence, and then those that probably dislike him or want Tiger to win or something, they take it as arrogance. But he's telling the truth. I mean, some people, if you've won it before, then you don't get intimidated by the course. But if you go in there maybe for your first time, or if you've never won this, or have never even been in the running, you're going to be intimidated. So that eliminates, like you said, a quarter or even more of the opponents.
So his last seven majors, where did he finish in the Masters? Do you remember where he finished in the Masters? I don't have that pulled up.
He was in the mix on Sunday.
In his last seven majors, he's won three of them and finished sixth in another. Didn't play in the Masters in 2018. I guess he was hurt.
Wrist injury.
That's right, so he's hurt. So this guy has, you know, he's won back-to-back U.S. Opens, and he's the defending champ of the PGA Championship. I mean, that's not Tiger level of good. But if he were to win this one and have four out of eight,
mm-hmm.
I mean, that is Tiger level of good at some point, right? For a guy that's only however old he is and playing in his, you know, fifth year of playing in the majors, to already have four titles is pretty impressive.
Total stud. All right, 615-737-1025. If you want to get in on any of the conversation, the NHL last night, Boston sweeps Carolina 4-0, outscores them 17-5 in the series. Golden State with a three-point win over Portland after the Blazers blow a 15-point lead. Golden State's up 2-0 in that series. And, of course, the PGA Championship round two today. Josh Ward, 6:30 this morning. Teron Davenport at 8 o'clock. And then Sean Henry, Predators president and CEO, at 8:30. Obviously, the big news, the Preds, Bridgestone, and three more decades.
Yeah, think about like our kids at 2049. Even if you're I don't want to call you an older father, Derek, mm-hmm. but you have older children. Just imagine where your kids are going to be in 2049. Like, think about that.
Yeah.
Like, my kids are going to be in their 30s. You too, Nick. Like,
my kids will still be fighting and driving me nuts.
2049 is insane to think about where sports, where Nashville, where media, where consumption, where the Preds, like where all this sports world is going to be. It's almost impossible to fathom where we're going to be. And one thing we can imagine very clearly is that the Nashville Predators will be playing at Bridgestone Arena in 2049, which is a great – at least the proposal's being reviewed. It seems like it's basically being agreed on. But it's – And it takes all the stress. The big bullet point, though, is it takes all the stress off of Davidson County taxpayers and puts it onto the more private sector. And that's a really amazing agreement that they've potentially put together.
Yeah, and then you know there will be some upgrades to the arena. I'm sure it will look, you know, much different. Even in I would say the next 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
It will look much different because you got to understand what they're building right across the street from it, from Bridgestone.
That thing gets bigger every day.
Yeah. It's going to be something on Fifth.
So
it's going to be a bunch of
it's all mixed
use.
Yeah, there's retail, there's condo spaces, and I don't know if it's rental or purchase, but there's going to be living space, and then there's retail, and then there's the. I believe it's the National African American History Museum of History for music.
Yeah.
So which is going to be a really cool sort of tent pole to have down there to sort of bring people in and look at stuff.
I would imagine
some towers going up at Bridgestone.
Like that's what I'm saying.
Like
yeah.
In the block at 501 Broadway, they've toyed with putting actual towers, office space or condos like in the actual. Not inside of Bridgestone, obviously, but on top of it, basically.
Yeah, it's going to be that whole corner, you know, in the next 10 years. So it's good that they've, you know, worked out a deal where the Preds are going to lease the space. And like you said, it takes the burden off taxpayers now, a lot of it. And now the private sector has to pay for it, which is good, which is what you want.
And the dollar figure I believe I read was 3,800 jobs created and $560 million in annual revenue that building brings into the city. I believe, Chase, you can check on this for me. I believe it cost $170 million to build. Incredibly controversial at the time. They didn't have a tenant when they decided to build it. The vision at that time in 1996, 97 of what this area could look like even in 08, none of this looked like this down here. So we talk about it a lot, but the vision that Phil Bredesen had to put that building where it was located without a tenant at $170 million price tag for it to be worth what it's worth now is just it's incredible foresight. And
$144 million
to build that. What do you think it would cost to build right now on that piece of land?
Oh man.
Like
It'd cost more than $144 million in bad land.
Exactly. It'd be. I don't think it'd be like one of those $2 billion football stadiums or whatever.
No, it wouldn't.
But you're probably talking $400-$600 million.
Yeah.
I mean, it would be an incredible amount of money.
615-737-1025. We are broadcasting live this morning from Kitchen Notes inside the Omni Nashville Hotel. Nick Braden, D-Mace, Chase McCabe live here on a Friday on Morning Drive on ESPN 102.5. The game, the game's most listened to. Drive Time Sports Talk Radio Show. Welcome back into Morning Drive, 619 here on this Friday morning. We are broadcasting live from Kitchen Notes inside of the Omni Nashville Hotel. Nick Braden, D-Mace, and kind of the constable.
Yeah, is he just like giving up on working with us now?
He is. This
he
is
just
his
checked, exit. Checked out on a Friday?
Long time
total
ago.
Exit strategy. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, he still got access to a microphone.
Who's that, Clinton?
Well, that microphone in studio
Colin?
Is very strong.
Yeah, Clinton, is that Colin back
is that
there?
Colin yeah. back there, Clinton?
Definitely yeah. Colin. Definitely Colin.
Here's my advice to you, Calvin, young pup here, running boards. Nick can tell the differences who's producing based on the music. You need to make it your own, okay? Calvin, if you're going to run the board, make it your own.
Hold on, was that?
Bring it unique.
All right, I'll bring my special flavor, don't worry.
Exactly.
Was that the theme song, The Bosom Buddies, that I just heard?
No, that's no. Billy Joel you keep.
No, but I'm saying, was that the theme song? I know.
I have no
that
idea.
Was hot, that was hot-blooded.
That was hot-blooded, yeah.
Oh, okay. I just heard the beat at the end.
Just check it and see, Mace. Yeah.
Producer Charles mixing it up here on the Friday.
Hey,
I'm just going to call him every C word but his real
Clinton,
name.
Clinton, Colin, Charles, Craig, Craig.
Chip.
Come on, Craig. Craig.
Chucky. So one thing I do want to get to, ESPN's Dan Orlovsky had an interesting quote yesterday, and I can't help, and I don't want to make this about Marcus.
Oh, my goodness.
But it just, the light bulb goes off when you hear
Hold on. You're walking into the bathroom.
No.
You're walking into the bathroom, he's going to turn on the water in a minute.
We'll stay out of the bathtub this morning because we're at Kitchen Notes.
Okay.
So we'll be in a different section of the house.
So he's not getting in the bathtub, though. What he does is he just is gravitating every single day to the bathroom.
That's what I'm saying. He's going into the bathroom. You got to stay out of there, man.
Like, not everything you read is about the bathtub.
So Dan Orlovsky from ESPN says, quote, more quarterbacks get ruined in the NFL than flat out fail. And he said that coming off of the McCagnan, Gase, Darnold, Jets thing that's going on in New York. And I don't know that he was necessarily saying that Sam Darnold's going to fail because of that, but I couldn't help but think of all the different offensive coordinators and head coaches and everything that Marcus has dealt with in 5 years or 4 or 5 years now with the Titans. Do you think that quote is true, that more quarterbacks are basically ruined in this league than they actually fail on their own lack of merit?
So I'll go back. You got to go back a couple of years because the 2 years ago, you've got Baker Mayfield, Sam Darnold, Josh Allen, Josh Rosen, Lamar Jackson. Josh Allen's already changed teams. I think that you would argue that's clearly a coaching situation, right? Or at least a general manager situation. Who knows about that? And Rosen hasn't been ruined yet, right? He might have a really nice career. The year before that, in 2017, you got Trubisky, Mahomes, Watson, first-round pick. So I'm trying to find busts, right? Paxton Lynch in 2016 was a first-round pick and has been a bust. Was that the Broncos' fault? Or is that Paxton Lynch's fault?
I never believed in him from the jump.
I'm with you. To me, that's Paxton Lynch. That has nothing to do with the Broncos. Then Jameis Winston, Marcus Mariota. Okay. Then you have Blake Bortles, Johnny Manziel, Teddy Bridgewater in the first round. All right. That's a good class we can look at in 2014. Was Blake Bortles ruined by the coaching staff? I don't think so. Mm. Was Johnny Manziel ruined by the coaching staff?
No, he was ruined by himself.
Right. Teddy Bridgewater, ruined by the coaching staff?
He's not ruined.
Injuries.
He's just injured.
Or injured.
Yeah, injuries.
Right. So far, we have not blamed a coach yet, right? For all these. We've gotten to like 5 or 6 busts now, and we haven't seen a coach be blamed for this. All right, here's an interesting one. E.J. Manuel, first-round draft pick, goes to Buffalo in 2013.
He had no business being drafted where he was drafted.
I think it was a combination of that team not really having any stability. And he shouldn't have been a first-round draft pick, even though he was drafted at, basically second round. He shouldn't have been a first-round draft pick. But that team was in flux, too. So
was that Marone that drafted him, though? Or that was his first year. I think it was his first year.
I think it was Doug
But then
Marone.
But then all the craziness with the organization happened,
yeah,
and then he decided to leave then. Again, I don't think that change ruined E.J. Manuel. I just don't think E.J. Manuel was he was the 16th overall pick. I'm with you, Nick. I think he was the only guy in that draft, and somebody reached on him, right?
Yeah, he's the only quarterback drafted in the first round.
Right,
yeah.
Exactly. So let's go 12. Obviously, Andrew Luck, okay, he's pretty good. Robert Griffin and Ryan Tannehill and Brandon Whedon. All right, so Robert Griffin, here's one you could argue that that Shanahan shouldn't have put him out there again when he was injured.
Yeah.
But that was a singular decision, right? Not like Robert Griffin should have learned how to not get destroyed every time he fell to the ground. Ryan Tannehill, Brandon Whedon. Tannehill's had some coaching changes, but he's had every chance to be successful. And Brandon Whedon, Cleveland kills quarterbacks, but was it the coaching staff or was Brandon Whedon just not that good? I'm not with Orlovsky. I think maybe it happens more than we think.
So if you go back 7 years or so, can we actually make the case that if you're going to take Orlovsky's comments, it applies most to Marcus Mariota with what he's endured
Because he hasn't been if we go back to the year before that, Cam Newton, Jake Locker, Blaine Gabbert, Christian Ponder. How about Christian Ponder, Blaine Gabbert, Jake Locker? Were they ruined by coaches or were they just not good enough?
Not good enough.
To me, all three of those guys are not good enough. So of the 10 busts we've found in the last 10 years in the NFL draft, maybe one, maybe two of them were coach-driven busts. I think you have to be a bust, right, to be ruined. I don't think Marcus has been ruined at all. I think Marcus is, again, don't tell me I'm filling up the bathtub here, but three straight winning seasons and a playoff win, and I think he's been a successful quarterback, not a great quarterback, but good, and I don't.
He's
been ruined.
How much better could – no, I don't think he's been ruined either. How much better could Marcus have been so far in these first 4 years if there was coaching continuity across the board for the whole duration of his career?
Let me put you in a situation, Derek, and you tell me how it works because you're the NFL player here. Mike Vrabel and John Robinson were in place with Arthur Smith when they draft Marcus Mariota. This is purely hypothetical, right? Mm-hmm. So when Marcus Mariota is selected second overall, it was John Robinson was the GM, Mike Vrabel was the head coach, and Arthur Smith was the coordinator. How different would this offense look today? All the other personnel stuff stays the same, right? They acquire talent as the years go along. But if the coordinator was the same, the head coach was the same, and the GM was the same through his entire career, how much does that help you as a player?
It helps you some, but I think ultimately, because they can't control injury history, they can't control, how the offensive line played. So maybe it would have been a little bit better. But a lot of this is put on put at the feet of Marcus, because I think Marcus is smart enough that he can pick up on these offenses, and to say, it's the offense fault or the coordinator's fault that Marcus hadn't been able to get his footing would say Marcus is not smart enough to learn an offense. And I don't think that's the case. Now, they're not going to throw the whole book at him and say, hey, listen, learn this, and then go out on Sundays, and we're going to run it from day one. They give him time. And I'm pretty sure they never really – each one of the coordinators never really fully got in depth with the playbook because they couldn't. So I think it's a little bit of both. I think Marcus still would have – if everything was the same but the GM and head coach, I think the injury history would have still been there. I think some of his struggles would have still been there.
Because it wasn't like he was a productive. I mean, his first game, he threw four touchdowns.
Yeah,
300
it's
yards.
Not like this.
He
guy,
was productive
yeah,
right out
was,
of the gate.
Yeah, it's not like all of a sudden he started off real bad and then Vrabel and them, John got here and Vrabel got here and all of a sudden things turned around. No. I mean, his best season was under Mike Mularkey. His best season was under Mike Mularkey in regards to
statistical.
Statistical. His best season was under Mike Mularkey. So. I don't think Marcus would have been he wouldn't have been drastically better. And it's not like he's a flop. It's just, he hadn't gotten – things hadn't worked out the way we thought they would with Marcus.
It doesn't change the injury stuff, but
exactly.
I do think he's better. I think if you've got 5 years of the same coordinator, same coach, same GM, without all that malarkey. That was pretty, I don't think that was dramatic for everybody.
I don't think in today's football you'd never get. I don't think
I'm not saying he's a Hall of Famer. But
what I'm saying is there's never. I don't think. I'm trying to figure out, has there been a team in the last 10 years that have had the same GM, the same offensive coordinator for 5 years straight?
Yeah,
I don't think there has been. Yeah.
That's a good point.
I mean, New England is probably the closest, but other than that, I don't know if there's been a team that 5 years straight had the same coordinator.
Well, and how many?
Or the same coaching coordinator.
I was going to say, how many of them have the same GM and head coach?
Yeah.
Belichick obviously is both.
It's the defensive coordinators that stay for years.
But typically defensive coordinators stay longer.
Because if you're good on offense, you're getting head coaching.
Exactly.
I mean, you're right, though. Just offensive coordinator for 5 years seems pretty insane. Head coach, the turnover rate on that is every 2 or 3 years at this stage. And then general manager, to have all three stay the same.
Yeah, you're not getting that.
Virtually impossible.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, what is going on with Jordan Bone, and will he, in fact, stay in the NBA draft? We'll get to all things Tennessee Volunteers related when we come back. Josh Ward from WNML in Knoxville is next here on Morning Drive. All right, welcome back into Morning Drive, ESPN 102.5 The Game. We're live this morning from Kitchen Notes inside of the Omni Nashville Hotel. Josh Ward, WNML in Knoxville. Actually, we don't have Josh Ward. Intern Colin, are we going to call Josh Ward this morning? Good talk. So,
Cologne!
One of the things that we're going to get to Josh with.
Josh may be sick. I'm not sure. We'll see.
Okay.
He might be playing hurt.
Jeff Goodman tweeted this out yesterday, and this is one of the questions I want to ask Josh. Jordan Bone on whether he has decided to stay in the NBA draft or not. Quote, "I'm making my decision on May 29th. Jeff goes on to say, still a little hope, Vols fans. Gut feeling, do you think he's coming back? Because he's not even close to being projected as a first-round guy.
I mean, if he's a second-round guy, I think that you still would, in his case, would you take that? I don't know. If you're not even projected a second round, I think you go back, work on your game. And
be the guy.
Yeah, and be the guy, because obviously it doesn't seem as if Schofield, because he's sort of moving up, Schofield is coming back. Grant Williams, it seemed like he is in a place where, unless things change, he's not coming back.
Well, and measured at 6'5", at 6'5", yesterday, which is not good news for Grant Williams.
All right, we will ask Josh Ward about all of that right now. Josh Ward from WNML in Knoxville. Good morning, Josh. How are you?
Hey, good morning. I should warn you, I've been on the injured list a little bit this week with the voice, so if 14-year-old Josh shows up during the segment, please excuse me.
You are excused right out of the gate. Jordan Bone, gut feeling. I know he said, quote, it's going to go up until May 29th to make a decision. Do you think Jordan Bone's coming back to Knoxville for one more year, or is he going to stay in the draft?
Yeah, my gut feeling is that Jordan Bone stays in the draft. He still has a lot to show from a basketball standpoint, and worked on that yesterday. But what he's really impressed teams with is his athletic ability, which we expected to be the case. I think most people expect it to be the case, at least. And the way that he measured out his vertical, his speed, I think NBA teams are going to look at that and be wowed by that. And it, again, comes back to the basketball question. But Rick Barnes was on our afternoon show a couple of days ago on our radio station in Knoxville and said that he has been operating under the assumption that Jordan Bone will stay in the draft and not return to Tennessee. And Rick Barnes also said that Grant Williams has been more in communication with Tennessee staff than Jordan Bone has. So it would be a change of mind, a change of heart for Jordan to return to Tennessee, which could happen, but my expectation would be that he stays in the draft.
Yeah, I mean, it's you haven't heard much of about Jordan Bone in the last couple of days. I know everyone was waiting on the measurements for Grant Williams, and as we speak, he stands with shoes, I believe, at 6'7" and a half. At 240 pounds, almost a 7-foot wingspan at right at 6'9". Do you think that he is a guy, he and Schofield, I know Schofield is gone and now going through the NBA combine, do you think his stock is rising in regards to where he could potentially go if he can crack that first round or even those top 20 picks. And then Grant Williams measuring in at 6'7", how much does that help him? Because no one truly knew whether he was 6'5", 6'7", because, you know, in college it's like you're 6'8", and you end up 6'2". But measuring in at 6'7", with shoes on, how much do you think that helps him?
Well, with Grant, I still think that teams are going to kind of hold his size or his height against him. But I also think teams have looked at Grant this week and confirmed what they probably thought watching Tennessee games, scouting Tennessee with Grant on the floor, and that is that his basketball IQ is off the charts. In interviews with teams, meeting with teams, he's going to wow them there. And I think just the feel for the game, the understanding what to do on the floor and what his role will be, because his role will be different in the NBA. He's not going to be a guy that the offense is going to run through like at Tennessee. He's going to have to change his game, and I think teams are going to trust that. But in changing his game, will he be effective as an outside shooter? Will he be able to defend well enough? Does he have enough quickness? I think that's something that teams are going to ask with maybe the lack of length. But as you mentioned, you know, his wingspan is greater than his height even. So I think Grant's in a position where he needs much greater assurance than Jordan Bone does to stay in the draft. I think Grant needs to absolutely know in his mind that he's a first-round pick and maybe a solidified spot, because if you believe you're a kind of fringe first-round, could slide into the second-round kind of guy, I don't know that Grant stays in that. And he's planning to make his decision, it looks like, this weekend. I've operated with the expectation that Grant stays in the draft because I've thought that he would be able to solidify a spot in the first round. But yeah, let's see if I'm right or wrong on that. Today's probably another important day. Today would probably be a good day to show off more shooting, depending on all that he's doing. But in terms of the mental capacity, his understanding of the game, I think he will wow teams there. Can he show that the way that he needs to change his game will happen at the next level? I think that's still to be determined for some NBA teams.
Josh, I was talking to some folks recently behind the scenes, scouting folks and college guys, and just about Tennessee and the program and Jeremy Pruitt as a coach. And one of the questions we've all had about Jeremy Pruitt, you know, we think he can recruit really well. We knew that about him. It looks like that's been true. We think he can develop players and coach them up. We'll see if that's true. But the one big general overarching question about him has always been, can he handle sort of managing a giant, you know, huge, you know, aircraft carrier like Tennessee football from a CEO captain standpoint? And do you think he's – what do you think he's learned in a year? And do you think he's evolved and changed at all in any of his sort of managerial style or CEO leadership ability? Like, are you seeing what you need to see, or is it still – does it still feel like he's learning a lot on the job?
I think it still feels like Jeremy Pruitt's learning on the job, which I don't think is a big surprise. He is still just a little more than a year into being the head coach at Tennessee. Some of the changes that I've seen came this spring, with some examples being that he let his assistant coaches talk to the media for the first time since he's been at Tennessee, besides his coordinators. His coordinator spoke to the media once back in August before the 2018 season began, but that was it. So guys like Chris Winkie and David Johnson meeting with the media, that was the first time. Tracy Rocker, Tennessee's defensive line coach. That is some kind of change there. But you're going to want to see more than that, right? I mean, it's not just, hey, the assistants met with the media in the middle of spring practice, so everything has changed. Chris Rumpf, a co-defense coordinator, did rave about what he's seen from Jeremy Pruitt and said that he's calmer and maybe more comfortable in the position. Chris Rumpf is in a biased position, but he's somebody who I do respect. If I'm going to talk about the assistants speaking, well, then what they say has to matter in some way. But it's more than that. It's managing everything behind the scenes. It's everything that comes with being the head coach at Tennessee. It's not just film and practice and getting your staff put together. It's fundraisers. It is cutting commercials that he does through Vol Network and with sponsors, and keep on going. And to me, that's to be determined. Meeting with the media. Even Jeremy Pruitt said himself that it was going to take him some time to get more comfortable in that role. But we have seen change. He's handed over the defensive play calling duties to Derek Ansley, which I never would have expected to happen, especially 1 year in. And let's see how that goes. So it is to be determined. It's the middle of the off season between year one and year two. And I think we should expect more change to be needed. But there are at least positive signs, I think, from where things were a year ago and where they are right now.
Josh, good stuff as always. We appreciate the time. You passed the voice test.
Yeah, I was knocking on wood going in, so I think that's what paid off for me.
There you go. Josh Ward, thanks, buddy.
You got it. Thanks, guys.
Josh Ward from WNML in Knoxville. All right, we'll come back. We'll react to a couple of things that Josh had to say on the Vols front. We also have the answer to one of the questions that we were discussing yesterday regarding the Tennessee Titans offense. We'll do that when we come back. But with the family relocating to Nashville and buying a new home, I realized something. Most home insurance policies, they were created back in the 1960s, and they are embarrassingly outdated. Hippo Home Insurance believes that people deserve better. My wife and I quickly realized that Hippo is smart insurance for the modern home that covers things that you really like and things that you really need, such as your computer equipment, your appliances, your HVAC systems, even your television for up to 25% less than what you're currently paying. Just go to myhippo.com/thegame and see how much you'll save in 60 seconds or less. Once again, that is myhippo.com/thegame to get your instant quote and save up to 25%. It takes a mere 60 seconds, so switch today and save. That is myhippo.com/thegame. All right, welcome back into Morning Drive, ESPN 102.5 The Game, live this morning inside of Kitchen Notes, the Omni Nashville Hotel. The talent has been fed, or is beginning to eat, so the energy level will only go up as we continue strong, because we don't mail it in on this show. Have you heard the shows this week that we had? I mean, come on. On Wednesday, the great guests, Caleb Plant.
I feel sort of like Will Ferrell from Old School in The Debate, where like we wake up on Friday and we're like, what just happened?
Where am I?
I blacked out a little bit. That's how good the shows were.
That's how good the shows have been this week. You can get all of them on demand at thegamenashville.com. Quickly, with Josh, when you asked him the question about Jeremy Pruitt and what he's learned about being the CEO of a major enterprise like Tennessee football, how much of it is, can we answer that question already by being, okay, he's taking his foot off the gas a little bit. He's letting Derek Ansley be the defensive coordinator and call the plays this year. How much of it is still in-game adjustments that we want to see from Pruitt? What do we want to see in year two beyond the obvious?
Yeah, so the people I was talking to yesterday, they still have the same concerns that I have, which is when you are the captain of a giant aircraft carrier like UT football, you have tons of personnel decisions, things that are not football related, right? You're talking about how do you deal with the medical staff? How do you deal with the media? How do you deal with the fans? How do you deal with the boosters? There's so much politics that goes into it. And for all of Jeremy Pruitt's strengths, it has been widely reported and known that his ability to sort of massage his message and be politically sort of inclined to, like, you know how you got to have some tact, right? You got to play the game, right? Especially when you're at that level, that he didn't have much of that coming in. And he's openly talked about how he has to be better about that. As long as you're winning football games, I don't think it matters how good you are at the other stuff. If you build a winning program, it doesn't matter if you're sort of abrasive to the media or you're not as good with the boot. Now, the boosters you have to be pretty good with, but you know, you can put your foot down on a medical decision or something else outside of football if you're winning games. Mm-hmm. We haven't seen that yet. Obviously, we know that's going to take time. So I still think there are still all the same questions. There are positive signs. Josh pointed out a lot of them, right? There's positive signs. If he doesn't kick a dry erase board this year, we'll realize that his in-game stress levels maybe are being more managed.
His temper.
Temper. But also, the Derek Ansley play calling thing, okay, that's nice now. What happens when week five you've played Florida and Dan Mullen and Felipe Franks, who I think is going to have an exceptional year for the Gators, and Alabama and Georgia, and all of a sudden your defense has given up a boatload of points to Dan Mullen, Kirby Smart, Jake Fromm, and Tua? Like, what is Derek Ansley still have the confidence of the coach, and is he still calling plays? That to me, I still think there's a lot of work that we need to see outside of recruiting and development to find out if he's really still the guy that's going to – it's still Boomer. When you talk to people So not necessarily off the record, but when you talk to people kind of behind closed doors about Jeremy Pruitt in Tennessee, the response is still that is a huge boom or bust hire. It's still very much they're either going to be really, really great or it's not going to work at all. There's not a lot of people that think it's going to be a middle ground situation at Tennessee.
Well, I mean, they're going to have to, in that situation, they're going to have to figure it out and figure it out very quickly because say if you wait the full 4 years or 5 years and you finally say, well, this is not our – you know, this didn't work between Jeremy Pruitt and the program. Let's move on. Then you're in a process now with starting all over again and pushing your program back even further.
And look what Florida did in 1 year.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I still think we're going to look back on history of the SEC. If it doesn't work like you're saying, I think we will look back on that John Curry almost had Dan Mullen signed to be the UT head football coach, and that if Chip Kelly just waits another day to kind of string Florida along, that maybe Mullen signs that paperwork and is the head coach of Tennessee, and we might be talking about a completely different situation because I don't think Chip Kelly would be doing the same thing that Dan Mullen did at Florida, and I think Dan Mullen could have. I think Dan Mullen is a proven elite level coach, so just think about what it could have looked like if it just. If the Chip Kelly thing drags out one more day and all of a sudden Mullen's in Knoxville, like you could be looking at Tennessee with 10 wins and, and challenging. So it can change. Florida in 1 year jumped over the top of Tennessee in no time.
But
they Florida, jumped South Carolina. They jumped everybody.
Florida had the talent. They had legit talent there.
Plus the more proven and accomplished head coach.
Yeah, and exactly. A guy that has been through.
What do you mean, Dan?
Yeah.
Yeah, Mullen no, being
that's
yeah.
what I, that's what I'm right. saying. Like he's yes, far more accomplished. I'm just saying,
and the talent. I think the talent was better at Florida.
Yes, but
proven talent, guys that
probably. But like Felipe, like defensively, probably yes. But Felipe Franks was he was a punchline.
Yeah,
I mean he was a joke. And now I think you're looking at one of the more dynamic of
just
the talents
what he
in the SEC.
Just think with Garantano, if that's the case.
I mean, I agree. Now, the offensive line, but the offensive line for Florida wasn't exactly all that great either. So
they wouldn't beat up like UT's.
No. That's different tier. But just think about that one decision and how it could have changed the entire balance of the East. Well, we are where we are, but Florida has gone past South Carolina, past Kentucky, past – now, I know they lost to Kentucky last year for the first time in three decades, but they won 10 games. In his first year, they won 10 games, and now they're a preseason top 10 team. Well, Florida's right back up there nipping at the heels of Georgia right now. And Tennessee still hasn't – they still need to get to a bowl game.
They ain't nipping at nobody's heels.
I mean, honestly, right now, like Vanderbilt, Kentucky, Missouri, South Carolina, Tennessee, how do you decipher between the four of them?
Right.
Like,
well, I mean, you could say Vandy has the most experienced coach, meaning he's been there. The longest at the university.
Stoops. Well,
how long has Stoops been?
Stoops,
yeah, he's been
Stoops
there
is going into his seventh year.
Yeah, so it'd be Stoops and then Derek Mason and then everyone else.
Well, if I had to do like a Cliff Notes real quickly of those four teams, I would say that Tennessee probably has the best overall recruiting talent of those four teams. Vanderbilt has the best offense if Riley Neal's the answer. South Carolina has best quarterback probably in Jake Bentley. But what else does South Carolina offer? We're not really sure. So, they have never beaten Will Muschamp. They're 0-7 against Will Muschamp. And Vanderbilt and Missouri have flat-out dominated them in on-field performance. So, we still got a lot of things that Jeremy Pruitt has to prove.
Yeah.
No question.
Well, here's the thing, though, with Pruitt. You give him credit for last year for beating Auburn, pulling that upset. But the question I have as far as the actual X's and O's of being a head coach, whether it's in-game adjustments or the preparation and the planning throughout the week, do you have any faith, any trust right now that Jeremy Pruitt in year two will either upset Florida, Georgia, or Alabama? He won't get ridiculed for losing those three this year,
right.
But eventually you need to find a way to beat those teams.
So he'll be a heavy underdog because the game's in Gainesville, and so he'll be a heavy underdog there. Heavy underdog against Alabama and probably a heavy underdog against Georgia. So, to your point, he's not going to get ridiculed for losing those games. If you do it with six turnovers against Florida again, you're going to get ridiculed for having a sloppy team. So, eventually, you're going to have to – like, you can't do it that way because they were sort of in that game, you know, when – was it Ethan Wolf who's diving down the sidelines and, like, knocks the ball out of his own hand and it's like, oh, that's the microcosm of Tennessee football right there. I don't know. I think – So here's one of the things I'm going to really pay attention to, because Jeremy Pruitt, talent developer, right? It's about getting guys to be better than they were before. That defensive line is full of a bunch of no-names. They're not elite-level recruits, and we don't know like whether or not the junior college players can play or some of the young guys can play. If that defensive front comes along, we know Batuli, we know Taylor, there's a couple good players in there. If that defensive front turns into one of the better defensive fronts in the East, not one of the best in the SEC, but one of the better defensive fronts in the East, I think you can point to game planning, talent development, and sort of building a baby that is his defense. That's one area I think I'm not going to look at Jeremy Pruitt and say, dude, you need to develop the offensive line. Like, that's not, you know, if both true freshman five stars play and they're good, well, then you give them credit for recruiting, right? So there are some things you can point to where this could be evidence of growth and progress and being
but
good.
But you still need to hold him responsible, because you hire the guy that is supposed to develop the offensive line. So if the offensive line doesn't get developed, you can't just put it all on the offensive line's coach. You got to say, well, Pruitt, you hired him, and to you, he was the best. The most qualified person to do the job. You thought he was going to come in here. You had confidence enough that he would develop a young, talented offensive line, but an offensive line that needed some help. And if this offensive line doesn't get any better from last year, and if they're not injured and they don't get better from last year, then it does, you know, a lot of it does fall on Pruitt, because you brought the guy in
right.
that was supposed to develop the guy.
And does he stay out of Jim Chaney's kitchen, right? Stay out of Jim Chaney's kitchen, because that was a big problem at the end of last year. You got involved in Tyson Helton's kitchen, and then all of a sudden, quarterback on the sideline of the Vanderbilt game doesn't know who's calling plays. Mm-hmm. Like, you can't have that kind of discord. You have to have everybody pulling in the same direction. Ideally, it's Jim Chaney's baby. And right now, I want to see Garantano get more control, which is what they're apparently doing.
All right, coming up next as we kick off hour number two, the Preds, Bridgestone Arena for three more decades. We'll tell you what it means beyond the obvious next here on Morning Drive.